Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Hi everyone, it's Han from Full of Beans. This week I'm joined by Vanessa Yim, David Villajone and Lynn Roberts. Vanessa is a clinical psychologist, David is a consultant clinical psychologist, and Lynn is a former patient from the ward that participated in the study. The study looked at patients' experiences of clinical team meetings or ward rounds in an adult inpatient setting, with the aim of improving clinical team meetings in order to give patients advocacy in their treatment, as well as weighing up different things like making them more personable and incorporating the patient's individual needs in order to make a treatment formulation that will work for them. As ever, there is mention of eating disorder behaviours, so if this isn't something that you want to listen to right now, please do know that this podcast will be here for when you are ready. With that in mind, let's get on with the podcast with Vanessa, David and Lynn.
Woohoo!
Here we are. What a journey. What a journey to get here. But so nice to see you all. And I think sometimes when you have like a bit of an issue at the start of a podcast, it actually calms everyone's nerves because you're just distracted by, okay, how do we get this technology working? So yeah, it's lovely to meet you all. I wondered if to start with, you just wanted to kind of go around and introduce yourself and maybe your role in the study and how you got involved in the study as well.
Yeah, sounds good. Should I kick us off then?
Yeah.
So I'm Vanessa and I'm now a clinical psychologist working in an eating disorders service. This project was part of my declin psych thesis. When I was doing my doctorate degree in clinical psychology in Oxford, and the setting was an inpatient adult unit for eating disorders.
Thanks, Vanessa.
My name is David. I'm a consultant clinical psychologist. So I worked in Oxford and I was part of the whole project of developing and changing the ward and the whole unit that we were, you know, the way we did things in terms of the treatments we offer and also the ward rounds. And I'm since then I've left and I'm now with another organization. And I was also Vanessa's supervisor.
Yep.
I'm Lynn, and I was an inpatient where I met David and through whom I met Vanessa in a hospital in Oxford from about February 2020 till July 2020.
Brilliant, thank you. Well, it's so nice to have you all here, and I honestly feel so, I don't know, normally when I, you know, do this kind of thing, talk to people about their research, it's with one person, so it's really nice to have such a range of perspectives, which I think will be so interesting for this podcast. So to start us off, you know, you've given a bit of a detail about yourselves, but we've mentioned the study in passing. What was the study that you did, and maybe if you want to give some background on the study and then what your aims were and why that was really important for an inpatient setting.
Yeah, sure. So maybe each of us can chip in. And maybe for me personally, we had to do a service related project for our thesis. And then I remember before I got onto training, I went to shadow a ward round in another eating disorder inpatient unit. And I remember going into, I think, 5 or 6 ward round meetings. And afterwards, everyone was crying. Like all the patients were crying during the ward round. I was like really shocked and was thinking like, oh, why was that? Like, we shouldn't be doing this to our patients. So I was really curious to see how we can improve patients' experience of ward rounds. And then I started looking into different types of research on this topic. And I found quite distinct methods being used. So like in the late 70s and 80s, they did a lot of observational studies around ward rounds, how many people were there, like how many minutes each person spoke. And then in the 2000s, the kind of studies became more qualitative in nature, and they started doing surveys around understanding people's experience, like staff and patients' experience. But none of them kind of used both methods at the same time. And then also none of them that I found had patients being involved in the design and analysis of the study. So I was kind of thinking, okay, it would be great to do something that kind of incorporate both staff and patients' experience, but also use both observational methods and also the kind of qualitative side of things. And then I met David and we kind of had really similar ideas. And at that time, he was kind of trying to improve the ward environment and his service. So maybe I can let him share how the project came about from his perspective.
Yeah, thank you. So we tried to base our model in Oxford on another model that was developed in Italy by Riccardo Della Grave and his team. And this new approach that they followed for inpatient units had really good outcomes. And it was a process where they tried to make patients far more at the center of the treatment and for patients to be actively involved in their treatment. And it was also based on a cognitive behavioral therapy approach. So I think it's probably fair to say that in the UK, most inpatient units are very eclectic, which that means, you know, different clinicians may use different models. So your dietitian might be working in one way, the psychologist might be following a CBT way, but the next psychologist, a psychodynamic approach, the consultant psychiatrist might be using another approach, the family therapist, another approach. So there were constant changes and no uniform model, you know, typically in inpatient units. So we wanted to develop a model that was uniform so that all the staff effectively used the same language, but also that patients were basically educated in the model so that they can also understand their difficulties in an integrated way. So it was an integrated approach that we wanted to develop, but also an approach that gave a comprehensive understanding of the patient's difficulties. So if you think about eating disorders, typically patients with eating disorders have issues with body image. I think we can probably recognize that. But every patient is really unique. So some patients may have, you know, a variety of dietary rules. They may struggle some with emotional regulation. Some may have issues with perfectionism or self-esteem and identity. Some patients may have a trauma history. The reality is every patient is completely unique. So we wanted to develop, we call it the formulation, so a comprehensive understanding of every patient's difficulties, and then develop the treatment plan based on that understanding of the patient. And I think the other thing we know is that patients don't want to tell their stories again and again and again. And that often happens when clinicians leave, or also when you hand over, let's say, back to the community team. So, and even as an inpatient unit, we almost had to assess from the beginning. So we wanted to have an approach that was seamless across clinicians and across teams. And then for this framework, I suppose, also to inform our ward rounds. And I think the essence was that patients should be far more involved. So historically, ward rounds are very, they came from a medical model, let's say in physical, let's say a cardiac unit or a kidney unit or a cancer unit, so which is very medical. But the reality is eating disorders are also very psychological. So we wanted to make our ward rounds far more psychological in terms of treatment and understanding. And again, you know, eating disorders are fascinating because it's a marriage between mind and body. So you have to think about both. So we wanted to bring both components into the ward rounds. And then also, I think by giving patients more agency, they get more control. So, and control is so important. And I think the outcomes and the patient experience is much better if they feel they have a sense of control and that they actually contribute to the ward round themselves rather than things just being told to them. I don't know if you want to say something else from a patient perspective, Lynn.
It's interesting hearing your explanation of the model, and which I feel is kind of like the ideal rather than, I don't know how long the model had been kind of integrated in at Cotswold House when I was there, but I'm quite vocal. And also I think I was probably older than a lot of the other patients there were when I was there. So, but even I felt intimidated at times.
What was it about the situation that made you feel intimidated in that process?
I think the number of people and people who you'd either only ever see on the day of the ward round when you had the meeting, or you would only ever see, I don't know, I saw the pharmacist once, for instance, and she was in my very first ward round, and yeah, so there's that, and there's also this, I think there's still a difficulty between how much agency can a patient, especially when they're first admitted, actually have. I think probably not nothing. So I mean, my first kind of what was known then as a CTM, which, you know, ward round CTM, I would say that was very traumatic. I felt I was being incarcerated and that I'd never get out of this prison, if I'm honest. And it did take quite a few weeks, you know, partly because I was very ill, but partly from I just didn't feel whatever I was saying was not being listened to.
It made me think about it when you were saying, David, about kind of, you know, the classic approach has been a lot more of a medical approach, because let's say you were in hospital for something, you know, let's say like cancer, you would just kind of listen to the doctor. They would tell you what your treatment's going to be, because at the end of the day, they're the expert. But then it also, Lynn, what you said about maybe, you know, your age, you being older than the other patients, it's also then interesting to think about the element of age, in that when he's younger, then the doctor may have more of a say over what their treatment is, whereas as an adult, you have that agency, you know, you are the one that makes decisions in life. And
part of the issue was that I was technically a voluntary patient, but I wasn't, because there was no other, you know, option. And right. I think it took me quite a few weeks to get over that, and to kind of understand, you know, to kind of to get with program, if you like, to understand that you know, it felt like the end of the world, but actually it was the beginning of a different world. And I don't know whether I'm, you know, I don't suppose I'm unique in that. But I do wonder whether something can be done to kind of ease that passage from doing what you want in a very eating disordered way, but what feels like safety, to being in a place that you feel is just kind of it's the opposite of safety.
You know, it's so helpful to hear Lynn talk, because these are the kind of things we were trying to address. And it also highlights just the stage of, you know, of the admission. Obviously, when patients come in, sometimes they are very, very unwell. And it's also about the stage of recovery in terms of, you know, where people are in terms of how committed and motivated they are to change. So that also sometimes fluctuates, you know, during the admission. And then I think the other reality is it can be very overwhelming. So there could be 10, 15, 20 people in a room perhaps, which just, you know, can be very, very overwhelming, especially if it's a big team. The other dilemma is sometimes the more complex the patient, the more people needs to be in the room, if that makes sense, if they want to think collectively. But that can feel overwhelming. And I know in Villegarda, they try to reduce the team to maybe 4 or 5 people maximum in the room, and also sit around, they call it a round table. So it's literally a round table. So we didn't have a round table, but there were far more people than I suppose the Italy model.
I think it was the opposite of a round table, David, because everybody was sat. Oh, it felt like an execution room, I have to say, because it was like everybody was sat along a wall.
Yeah, also bringing in the kind of COVID component where actually most of the professionals were not allowed to enter the ward. So it was actually lots of people on screen, and then the patient and nurses was in the room. So that also maybe increased a sense of distance and not knowing the consultant or other professionals who were part of the treatment.
Yeah, I suppose not having everybody in the same room, it can feel very out of touch. And just interesting that did, when you were doing that over COVID, was it like a thing like now? So if I was the patient, let's say, I would be able to see everybody's faces, or was it sort of the patient just felt like they were in the room with the nurse and then everybody was listening in?
I think maybe it changed because I was in the first wave of COVID. It would be maybe the staff who were on that day, there might be a couple of nurses in the room physically, and then there would be different kind of team members on screen, but it was difficult to see everybody at the same time. I don't know. Yeah, I seem to remember that it was usually just the person speaking that you could see.
Yeah, and I think it just highlights, you know, that was, you know, the pandemic, so we had to learn how to go hybrid overnight. So that was the other dilemma. So you would have, thankfully we did have a big screen, but I don't know at the time whether everybody, initially I don't think everybody could appear on the screen, and it changed during the pandemic. So initially, you know, we weren't allowed many people in a room, so it was only a few people and then many people on screen, and then gradually that probably, you know, decreased, so more people in the room. But it was definitely challenging. It complicated things even more, I suppose.
It almost made me think of, I've never been in this situation myself, but in a prison, you know, when you're being like interviewed in a prison thing, and then there's people behind the mirror who can see you, but you can't see them. It almost made me think of that in terms of like, you know, you're disclosing information that's very personal to you, and you're not 100% sure like who's listening and stuff, which I can imagine would create quite a barrier to disclosing information and sort of the stuff you were talking about, which I did just want to ask before we go on, for people that, you know, that are listening that maybe don't know what a ward round is or a clinical team meeting, what sort of things are discussed within those meetings, and who does tend to be involved in them?
So I think ward rounds happen all over the world, probably every day of the week in hospitals all over the world. So it is actually a really important meeting where all the clinicians, all the people who work with the patient come together and think about basically the patient's treatment. So it's a place to think about the latest assessment results, you know, from any tests that were done. For patients, typically it would be an update on their weight or their blood tests. But it's also an opportunity to hear from the nursing staff how it's going on the ward, from the dietitians, from the social worker, if there are kind of external factors that needs to be considered. It's an opportunity to hear from the family therapist, the psychologist. So it's a really important meeting. It's probably the only place where the whole team comes together to think about the patient, to think about, you know, how it's going, to think about the risks, to think about the treatment plan. So like I said earlier, it's also about to think about the formulation. So, you know, what are the key maintaining factors for the patient's eating disorder? Is it perfectionism? Is it self-esteem? But then also to think about the physical component, you know, in terms of their physical health and well-being. And then, like I say, historically, I think patients typically weren't included. So when we, even in Oxford in 2014, patients weren't included in the ward round. So the team of professionals would meet and then somebody would deliver the message. So that was one of the things we wanted to change. And I think that was actually one of the great outcomes of Vanessa's piece of work, is that patients had far more airtime effectively in the ward rounds than historically.
It gives a really nice overview actually of what the meeting involves. And I just wanted to pick up more on sort of the patient involvement there, because you kind of mentioned it before, in terms of during somebody's treatment, they're going to be at a different kind of cognitive capacity in terms of their involvement in their treatment. And so I was just wondering, like, how, you know, does that change? Does that dynamic change throughout someone's treatment? Is it at the start you kind of have to take a hands-on approach and maybe the patient has less involvement and then they become more responsible for kind of giving ideas about their treatment? Or how have you started to navigate that now?
Yeah, so like I say, you know, patients come in at a variety of levels of being unwell. So some could literally be at risk of, you know, of dying. So whereas other patients would be informal and they would be committed to treatment. So there's probably two components. The one is that on the one end, some patients might be physically very unwell, cognitively very unwell, and perhaps not able to make, you know, sound or decisions. But then the second component is the motivation to change, you know. So we know eating disorders is a lot about ambivalence. So whereas some patients may arrive and be admitted because they want to get better, some might be against their will even, so they might be sectioned, or they may be very ambivalent or even say, I don't want to get better. So it's kind of managing both those factors, I suppose, especially at the beginning of the admission, you know, that typically change over time. But that is challenging. And then, of course, as professionals, it's sometimes about keeping somebody alive. So that might mean taking decisions that the patient don't agree with at the time.
How did you find it, Lynn, during your inpatient stay? Kind of, you said at the start that, you know, it took you 3 weeks or so to kind of get that cognitive ability back. Did you notice maybe more of a shift from the eating disorder being like, okay, we should suggest this in treatment, to kind of your more, I guess, healthy mind, if we're going to call it that? How did that sort of progress for you during your treatment?
I think I can remember the moment when I actually understood that there were, like, you know, there was a big conflict in me. And I think, and that probably was at about 3 weeks in, I had to start having iron supplements, and it just felt like the final straw. I was just weeping, and then a member of staff came and it was just like, oh, okay, so this is where the eating disorder mindset comes in. I get it. And I think that was probably, I mean, I wouldn't say a turning point, especially in motivation, because I was motivated, but not enough to kind of go, you know, just to kind of trust the process. But I would say from then, it was more like, what other process have I got to trust? So that, and I think it was just really gradual, seeing how weight restoration is really, really hard, both physically and mentally. But it's not so hard that you can't breathe or you can't move. You can move, you can breathe, you know, you can have a fairly okay day, you can have more fairly okay days until that becomes the norm. So yeah, and I think I just you know, I was very lucky with the staff who were there at the time, and I think the main thing is I started to trust the program. And then once you do that, you feel that you do have more, you can inform your kind of treatment path, if you like.
Yeah, and when you were speaking then, trust was something that came into my mind, and I was going to say, you know, to all of you, like, that level of trust, I guess, in one respect, how important is that trust between a patient and a clinician, but also how do you go about developing that trust? Because I think, you know, eating disorders can very much twist things, and every sort of, you know, thing that a clinician would be trying to do would be to promote the patient's health, and the eating disorder would be like, no, don't listen to them. I can imagine that's quite a difficult thing in order to develop that level of trust between the client, the patient and the clinician.
I mean, I think maybe that's where Vanessa's research project, that's one part of the kind of the whole jigsaw, isn't it, Vanessa, in terms of having more patient involvement in CTMs, making them less anxiety provoking. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I guess we can bring in the kind of CTM and ward round difference here probably, because before my project, actually, there was a previous audit that was being done that patients probably feel like clinical team meetings, which is CTM, is a better language than saying ward rounds, which might give patients more agency in terms of speaking up or going into those meetings, rather than that being something being done to them or like a message of their care being delivered to them. So what I was trying to do was actually, I think through research, it can be like a more objective and independent way to gauge how they feel about ward rounds or how they feel about the service, because I'm someone who is independent to the service and they could share their honest feelings about ward rounds to me. And then I can be someone who kind of come in from like, again, a more objective angle into how we can improve this whole process for them. So I think in some ways, like maybe in terms of trust as a researcher, I was fortunate to be someone who's trustworthy, so then they can share how they feel at that time to me and trust me in that I could potentially come up with or help them to explore some of the things and put the findings into something that's kind of maybe service improvement initiatives and things like that.
I was going to ask you, Lynn, what else do you think help patients to trust the therapist or clinicians?
Gosh, that's a difficult question, David.
Yeah.
I think having confidence that the clinicians kind of understand where you're coming from, even if they don't agree with what you want to do or you know what your mindset's like, but appreciating that at that moment that is your reality. You know, it's at that moment that's your reality, that you're finding a situation or a meal or talking about things really, really uncomfortable, and being able to, so from a clinician's point of view, being able to appreciate that and maybe approach things in a different way. I think it's also relationships with different members of staff, because everybody has different approaches. So yeah, it's quite intangible, I think, that.
Yeah, but I suppose what you're saying is, do you think it's partly competence, partly sort of the clinician's experience?
I think having like interest and not feeling that you're just the next patient, which, you know, we are. I think those meetings, because when I was an inpatient, they had disproportionate importance in terms of the week's event. So if they were kind of more involved with patients, and this is pre-Vanessa's research, then I think that would go a long way. Because it did feel at times that, especially during COVID, I think, because you couldn't do a lot of the things that were involved in the kind of rehabilitation process, if I can use that word, as in visit the outside world, be off the grounds of the hospital. So it did feel a lot like, okay, this is weight restoration. And we had kind of formulation groups with David, and I think the CTMs are pretty important in setting up that kind of trust and kind of team approach to your treatment, rather than than you following somebody else's, like, this is what's going to happen, this is what you're going to do.
Yeah. And can I ask, do you think the formulation helped you to feel understood and therefore that you could trust the team or the clinicians?
I mean, it certainly made me, like, exploring it, it made me understand that things I thought was on what I was on top of or that just weren't an issue actually were an issue. So I don't know, I'd say more it was very helpful in helping me understand myself. And I think if you the more you understand yourself, the more you can say what you feel you need. So it's not kind of so much like detection work on the part of the clinicians.
Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, when we're talking about trust and things like that, I think something that kind of came to my mind is the importance, and I think you kind of highlighted it then, of getting to know that individual. Because I think, like you said, it could be very easy to kind of see someone as their diagnosis and see them as their behaviours and then not actually see how that fits for the individual. And I imagine, obviously this is all coming from assumptions for me, but, you know, the bigger the team, the harder it then is to connect with somebody on that personal level. You know, you said kind of the teams could be 15, 20 people, and I can imagine all of those eyes onto one person could be quite difficult to build that connection. So I was just wondering, you know, from whether it was from doing the study or kind of your experience, how you've been able to kind of develop that connection with patients. Maybe David, you could expand.
I think it's difficult. The other dilemma is, which I think I mentioned to Lynn and Vanessa, is the other dilemma is that we also have to train the next generation of staff. Mm. So sometimes you may have a trainee dietitian, a trainee family therapist, a trainee, two or three trainee doctors, a trainee social worker, trainee nurses, all of them in the room too. You know, so that's something almost like add a third or a double. So, and of course, we ask patients whether it's okay for them to be there. And if they say no, then they leave. So that was the other dilemma, is that we need to train people. Which means that, again, adds to the number of people. I think, you know, this is why it's such a good to have this podcast. And I think as clinicians, we need to think about ward rounds all the time. And we just sometimes, if I'm honest, get into the motion. We just do it. And, you know, it's one after the other. And we need to sometimes put in many patients per day. But we need to stop and think and, you know, reduce it to the minimum number of people in the room, and also the people who are really actively involved with the patient. You know, I think that's probably true for many. I assume units is that they try to think about this, but I think the formulation also helped the team to understand the patient. You know, it's so easy to see, or to say we have 14 patients with anorexia, but actually they are completely unique. So you can't treat everybody the same because they've got anorexia nervosa, or, you know, because they're completely unique. So in that sense, I think the team needs to understand how each person is unique. And hopefully that'll help the patient to feel understood and therefore perhaps trust the team more.
Yeah, I think that kind of acknowledging someone's individuality is so important. And I think Vanessa, one of your findings from your study was about how important ward rounds are but can be quite impersonal, and I wondered if, you know, what came from that in terms of to make it less impersonal from your study.
So I was thinking when David spoke, it would be very quite nice to bring in the findings and see how it can inform how we can improve the experience, because, like what Lynn and David were saying, like ward rounds are the place where important decisions are being made, like whether people can go on to leave or whether they will be discharged sometimes. But at the same time, we know that it's quite impersonal because there are so many people in the room, whether it was on screen or in person. And sometimes that might be the only time where they see their consultant psychiatrist, or like what Lynn was saying, this is the only once that she saw the pharmacist. So this can feel quite impersonal, and for the patients it can feel like these people only know me very briefly, but they are making very important life decisions and treatment decisions for me. So that was something that felt quite prominent in terms of the themes and the findings of the study. So after I got the findings and analyzed it with Lynn together, we came up with a few kind of improvement initiatives. So one was really to make use of their named nurses, because named nurses are the ones who would spend the most time with the patients. And maybe if they were trained up to support the patients in the ward rounds and maybe help them to do like an agenda together in terms of what they can expect during ward rounds, and if possible, whether the named nurses or healthcare assistants who know the patients the best could also attend the ward rounds. It could help with the impersonality kind of aspect of the ward round. So that's kind of what I did afterwards, where I did a training session with the nurses in the ward, informing them of the findings and what we thought about, and then I also went to a patient community meeting and told them the findings I got, and they agreed of the kind of improvement initiatives we came up with, and they also kind of said that it would be nice to have an agenda sheet where it was given on a Sunday, so the day before the ward round, so then they can prepare for it in advance.
Yeah, because I mean, I can imagine that there's quite a lot of anxiety around the ward rounds, because that's going to be the time that, you know, either changes are going to be made to your treatment plan, or you know, which can be, I guess, quite scary if you're thinking about weight restoration and maybe things are going to be boosted up there. And I think that was another one of the findings that you had, was around like the anxiety that comes with ward rounds. And were the sort of interventions that you suggested to reduce that anxiety, were they similar to that impersonality, or were there additional things that you wanted to put in place?
Yeah, so something were similar. So for example, the agenda, because I think in one of the quotes in the paper, some of them mentioned there was this secret bag of things that they don't know whether they could access. And so like it kind of reflects maybe people didn't have they didn't know what to expect really when it comes to ward rounds, especially like what Lynn was saying in the beginning, first few ward rounds. Maybe after a while they might get a hang of like what they could do or what they could ask for. So then having an agenda would be helpful. And they also, we kind of thought about setting in terms of the ward timetable, because ward rounds are usually on a Monday. So they could kind of plan some more relaxing activities on a Monday evening or late afternoon where everyone can just chill, and also maybe scheduling in one-to-one times with their named nurse on the Monday to kind of like check in and see how they are feeling and how they are doing. But I think one thing that it was what came out quite strongly when I was analyzing the actual CTM meeting transcripts was the idea of request. So people kind of use the words like request, or I need to ask for this. So it really reflects the kind of power difference between the patients and the staff. And I felt like ward round is just one of the, it's not an isolated component. It kind of reflects the whole dynamic, the power dynamic between the patients and staff. And so like in some ways, even if we change the agenda sheet or we kind of train nurses to facilitate the ward rounds, it doesn't change the power difference massively. Like patients might feel they have more agency, but then the language they're using is still about, I need to ask for things or I need to request for things.
When I was an inpatient, that was also the language used by staff. You know, I remember the dietitian asking me, well, have you got any requests this week? So, you know, that there is a power imbalance that, you know, you can't get away from that. But I think when because an eating disorder is very much about control, and I think possibly that's one of the things that I found hardest, was I went from working on a Monday to having to, I don't know, ask if I could have a glass of water, which I couldn't because I'd already had a glass of water, you know, when I was an inpatient on the Tuesday. So I think that it felt like a taking away of liberties. So then, you know, which compounds a certain power dynamic, basically. Yeah,
it was really interesting because when I did the training session with the nurses, they were all not surprised, but they were like, oh yes, actually they have been actually using these wordings without realizing they were perpetuating the power difference. But I agree with you, Lynn, that there is an inherent power difference, but it's kind of, again, finding the balance, like how to give agency to people, but also acknowledging there will be power imbalance.
I just think it just highlights how important it is to involve patients, you know, in their care. And because we do things well-intentioned, but we may get it wrong, very wrong at times. And just, you know, getting the feedback from patients in all aspects of the services that we deliver is so important, and even in research, because they bring important perspectives and they're actually on the receiving end of what we do. So it just highlights, it's really important and good to hear from, you know, Lena and again, Vanessa's project.
I just want to ask a question, and I don't want this to come across in the wrong way. This is coming solely from my personal experience of having an eating disorder. I kind of get the need for the power dynamic, but the sort of the reason why it's there. And my sort of thought is, in the depths of an eating disorder, in my personal experience, I didn't know whether what I wanted was what Han wanted or what the eating disorder wanted. And so then I kind of think it is great to give somebody agency, but how can we be sure that they want that for themselves and for them, their health, rather than their eating disorder? Because, you know, I don't want to be horrible, but my eating disorders are so manipulative. And as somebody that's had one, like, my thoughts were like slush puppies. I had no idea what was Han and what was the eating disorder. So how do you navigate that in that sort of area? Because you want to give somebody agency, you know, because they are a human being at the end of the day, but equally they've got this, you know, almost demon inside of their head trying to do everything against you.
It's interesting what you said, Han, about the demon. That's true, but I do think saying that's your eating disorder speaking was used a bit too liberally, because sometimes I'm just in a bad mood. I don't particularly like that thing that is put in front of me. And then I'm told it's your eating disorder. Have you tried that? You know, have you tried that food stuff that you're, no, I haven't. Okay, well, give it a go. And then you let me know whether it's my eating disorder or actually that isn't very nice, you know. But I, you know, I agree. It's really hard, because I think, I mean, when I'm speaking about agency, on the one hand, I'm kind of speaking about doors being locked, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm on the other hand, I'm also speaking about agency to kind of shape their treatment, or shape, you know, my treatment as it was. And it is tricky because, well, from my experience of being an inpatient, it was in the first lockdown, it was very kind of uncertain times, you know. Heroically the staff found a way of like making the treatment work. But for me, I had a big like hang up about when I was about to be discharged, and I hadn't been in my house for 5 months. I hadn't been outside or off the grounds of the ward for 5 months. You know, how would I not crash and burn? And I built it up so much in my head. You know, and eventually I did get some leave before I left. But So I'm thinking about agency like that, and as in, please listen to me, this is a real fear of mine. And even if you don't think it might happen, you know, deep down inside me, this fear is so big that it's kind of inevitable that it won't go smoothly. So that's the kind of agency I'm talking about, I think.
Again, I think it just highlights how complicated this it is, because, you know, initially we also don't know the patient. So there's something about trust the other way and knowledge the other way, you know. So initially we may think, you know, this is just a fear food, but actually over time we learn that actually this person doesn't like that specific type of food or brand or whatever. So I think initially we get it wrong because we don't know the patient, and also we don't know whether we can trust them yet. And then secondly, it's complicated by the eating disorder, you know, voice. And I think as clinicians, we can normally spot the eating disorder voice, but of course we get it wrong at times. So that is also, I think, you know, the challenge. So it's complicated trying to get it right, I think, especially at the beginning. Then over time, I think we get to know the person better, the eating disorder better, and the unique presentations, plus there's increasing trust, and we can take what people say on face value. And of course, you know, we should do that more, but then if we do it and we get it wrong, and the eating disorder, if we give into the eating disorder, then of course things can go wrong. So it's challenging on both sides, probably.
Yeah, I think what you've just said there just really highlights to me, you know, the importance of all the things we've mentioned in terms of communication and trust and things like that, you know, really listening to the patient and really, you know, if somebody says I'm concerned about this, like actually sitting down with them and trying to understand why they're concerned about it, rather than just like, you know, oh, that's, you know, it's just your eating disorder or whatever.
Yeah. We've heard it before, but actually, you know, it every mm-hmm. patient is unique, so we've never heard it before because everybody is different.
Yeah. And I think another theme that you had, Vanessa, was around differing goals for the ward rounds, kind of team meetings, whatever we're going to call them. And I think that's quite interesting, because I was kind of interested as to what the differing goals were, like what, you know, the patients felt was most important compared to the clinicians, and how they aligned.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the areas is about the sharing of the formulation. So as you heard from David, the goal, what the kind of service wanted to do, was to move from a more formulation-based model and kind of having more psychological sort of input in ward rounds. So I kind of explored that with some of the patients, and some of them said to me, formulation is a very personal piece of work. Like they might kind of include their trauma history or different things that they wouldn't want to share with the wider team, especially when some of the team members were quite maybe like strangers to them, they would describe. So they wouldn't want it to be shared in those meetings, whereas the staff were pushing for a formulation to be shared. And sometimes also the goals of the ward round might be about taking leave, and then the staff might be more focused on their weight, and then using the weight as an indicator to see whether they could leave, take leave that week. So there's been some, I suppose, difference in expectations and goals about CTMs. We kind of like came to a bit of a consensus in some ways about how formulation can be shared. So maybe it would be about sharing bits of the formulation that they feel comfortable with in relation to their admission goals, but not the whole document in front of all the staff. But also when they do request, or not use the word request, but if they do want leave, it might be about how that leave would be in service of their goals. So like whether it's about improving their interpersonal relationships or challenging some of their fears by going out to have a meal, for example, and kind of reframing it that way, rather than saying I'm requesting leave as an example.
I have to say it was very weight driven, or whether you'd stuck to your meal plan. I mean, I would say, you know, I was kind of, I'm a bit of a goody two shoes, so I did tend to stick to my meal plan. But, you know, going back to the agency issue, the kind of disappointment set in it at COVID, because as patients, we felt that we were sticking to our side of the bargain, if you like. But there was nothing, you know, there was nothing that we could have back, because there was no like ground leave or this or that or visitors or so. Yeah, I say this is probably something, you know, like you were mentioning, Vanessa, about reframing the purpose for things rather than I want leave this weekend so I can just have a bloody weekend off, to, you know, I want leave this weekend because then I can work on this, that and the other. Yeah, I say, you know, that's the ideal. But I think that, you know, limitations of lockdown kind of stymied that for me, really.
I think that area, like that part about COVID, is really interesting because, and please excuse me if I'm taking this the wrong way from what you've said, but it almost sounds as though like sort of leave is dangled as a carrot in terms of like, you know, if you do this, then you can get leave. I don't know whether that is.
I mean, I don't know whether it is dangled like a carrot or was, because it, you know, we're talking about nearly 3 years ago. Maybe that is how, as patients, we spoke about it. I'm not sure whether that's how staff necessarily thought. I mean, there is, or there was, like a handbook, and maybe this is where it stems from, because at each, BMI point, you knew what you'd be allowed to do, allowed, you see, I'm still using the terminology, at certain BMI points. So at this BMI point, you can have 10 minutes ground leave a day. At this BMI point, you can have one overnight like leave. So I think, you know, it goes deeper than language. I would say that the system was pretty much built up on you reach this weight and then you can, you know, you're allowed to do this. So I wouldn't say it wasn't specifically dangled like a carrot, but all the indicators where this is what matters, you know, so yeah.
I find that really interesting as well. And again, if I'm making the wrong assumption here, please do just correct me. But I can imagine, I've not been in an inpatient setting myself, but I can imagine that there's quite a lot of comparison. Did you find sometimes that, like, you know, if somebody was allowed to go and do something new, was it almost like, oh, that means that they've reached another BMI point? Or...
Oh, I mean, all the time there was comparison. I mean, jealousy, you know, I was jealous of people who had grand leave and I thought that is impossible. How come they've had grand leave? Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can avoid that in a ward of perfectionists and, you know, judgmental as well. That's what comes with an eating disorder. Yeah, that wasn't a nice part of being on the ward, but yeah.
Again, I think this is really interesting, you know, because there's so much comparison, it's probably on balance better to have some criteria. And of course, the criteria were partly based on, you know, what is physically healthy, you know, so that people don't go, you know, for long walks if they're not physically ready for it yet. But if you allow one person at a very low weight to go out and somebody else not on at a very high weight, then that created, you know, its own sort of challenges. So in that sense, I think we probably tried to have at least rules that everybody know what they are. And it's hard to know, is that better than individual rules? And then people challenge, but why can they do it and I can't? So that is the challenge.
I think you do need benchmarks, but again, yeah. it's whether it was what my mind wanted to see or whether it was reality, you know, these were the rules. There was no context around it. You know, yes, I was told, oh, you know, you're too ill to do this at the moment. But that didn't help my feeling of anger. Again, it's, you know, it was the eating disorder speaking, but the clinicians have to get through that like anger, that eating disorder, kind of, I don't know, the eating disorder mood, if you like, to be able to kind of develop the trust with the patient. So, you know, I agree, you do need benchmarks, and but there needs to be more than that, I think.
what's so interesting for me is that coming from a researcher's perspective and then seeing or hearing what David and Lynn were saying, it kind of really echoed with the research process as well, because on one hand, I got the patients' experiences and them sharing their frustrations and their feelings and their thoughts. And on the other hand, I hear from the staff as well, maybe their limitations and constraints about the difficulties in maybe accepting or kind of agreeing to everything that the patient said. So then when we came up with the kind of improvement initiatives, it did feel like it's just like a tip of the iceberg. Like CTM is not the only thing we need to change or talk about, is the whole kind of ward culture, but also what are the realistic things I can change as a researcher. It's quite minimal from some perspective, because there's always tension between staff and patients.
Yeah, I was going to say that earlier, actually. I think that was like something I picked up on right at the start when you were saying about the study, and that it's so brilliant to have the clinicians' opinion and experience, and also have the patients. But it's almost finding that happy medium of, you know, bringing both opinions and values, which are equally as important, because, you know, as staff, you need to be able to function, you need to be able to do your role to support somebody logistically on a ward. But equally as a patient, you know, this is your life and you want to feel comfortable and safe and held. And even in that, like we've said so many times, that approach is going to be so individualized as well. So it sounds, you know, good on you guys for taking on this project. But I think, like you said, it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of kind of where things need to go forward. It's hard.
Yeah, I fully agree. And I think, again, this is so good that Vanessa did this project, because there's actually not much written in the literature around clinical team meetings or ward rounds. So hopefully this will trigger more debates and for other units to think about their sort of, you know, how they do things and why they do it, and then perhaps do more research on the whole topic, I suppose. But it's also true, it's part of the whole culture and how we do inpatient admissions.
I guess part of it is to do with funding, though, David, as in, you know, there's limited money available, there's a growing need. What's the most cost efficient way of treating?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. So, you know, we can do so much more with the right resources and funding. So sometimes we don't get things right because we're so under-resourced and stretched, you know. So that's the other dilemma. How do you offer individualized care if you don't have enough staff for every person, you know?
And I think one of the problems is that it takes a long time. It takes a long time, and it continually takes a long time. So reaching or kind of restoring to a healthy weight is just one thing. You've got the months, the weeks, the years after that. Where, I mean, again, you know, I'm not under any treatment now, but I still have to do a lot of work and to kind of stay healthy. But, you know, my time with treatment was, yeah, it wasn't months. It was at least a year and a half of community treatment after that. And I think, I don't know, I mean, having the resources to be able to offer to that to kind of everybody is quite tricky. I'm not saying it's right, it's far from right. But you know, I saw people who fellow patients, this was their second, this was their third, this was their fourth admission. So, you know, surely that isn't cost effective either. But that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess bringing back to the research findings, as you kind of might have seen on the table in terms of who was present in the CTM, there was no psychologist who attended the CTM when I was observing. So it was an MDT, there was a nurse, there was a dietitian, there was a psychiatrist, but then there was no
psychology. So basically it's an MDT, but also not an multidisciplinary team, because it kind of lag one aspect of the input. And that's, again, might be back to resources, or there are lots of reasons, but it also is like a limitation in terms of how we can create changes, because if one profession was actually missing, what would that mean in terms of the content of the CTM, for example?
I think the point there that you've made about the resources is obviously, I mean, it's something that we've spoken a lot about on the podcast, and, you know, it's very apparent that everybody working in eating disorders is so passionate and really wants to provide that best treatment, that the resources just aren't there. But what you were saying, Glyn, about it being people's third, fourth, you know, whatever inpatient admission, I know obviously we're not here to talk about community treatment, but I think there is a massive need as well for that sort of handover from the inpatient team that supports somebody to then the community team. And because I think in my eyes, the inpatient admission tends to be to get somebody weight restored and back to sort of a healthy weight. And then the maybe community work is more when recovery actually kicks in, when you start building those coping mechanisms and things like that with all the cognitive work. But to have a really clear handover there so that that can be productive, so that people aren't sort of running almost back to the inpatient setting, that, you know, you might feel more held, or kind of, I don't really know how somebody might feel, but there must be a reason why somebody is obviously going back. Maybe they're deteriorating because they've not been able to put things into place in their home as they were doing in the hospital.
Good to hear what Glenn thinks. You know, I think that was exactly the one of the things we wanted to change in Oxford, was that we wanted to acknowledge that psychological treatment is a key part of recovery from an eating disorder. So we wanted to, you know, there's this idea that you go into hospital to weight restore, sort of focus on the body but not the mind, whereas actually we, you know, we gave an intensive psychological treatment to many patients. I think Vanessa's right. So by the time she did the study, there wasn't anybody in post. But many patients before that had, you know, very intensive psychological treatment, which then I think continued in the community team. And that was, we've seen the best outcomes for those patients who had effectively seamless psychological and, you know, physical health monitoring and treatment across the pathway. So, you know, ideally start with psychological treatment in the community, then almost get more intensive psychological treatment as an inpatient. And that continues then with a good handover in the community. So I think yours was fairly seamless, Len. Would you agree? Or how did you experience your therapy across the pathway?
I would say it was seamless. Yeah, I would say if I hadn't have had the kind of foundations of it as an inpatient, then coming back home would have been really, really difficult. I mean, it was difficult, but in different ways than I imagined. But I think kind of the success rate might have been lower had I not had the grounding in an inpatient setting, because you have, I mean, to use Han's word, which I really like, is held. So you have your session with psychologist or whoever, and then that does bring up lots of feelings afterwards, which can usually kind of show themselves in certain behaviours. So if I were, and I live by myself, if I were by myself at home, you know, going through all the beginnings of the psychological treatment, then it would have been really difficult not to act out. And also, you know, kind of having some tools about how to continue eating regularly, how to have all your meals, how to have all your snacks. And, you know, without like even going through those, they're not even coping mechanisms, they're kind of staying safe mechanisms, and understanding why you need to do that and understanding what could possibly try to take you off course. You know, unless you've got that already from being an inpatient, then it's really difficult to be, I think you need to be as robust as you can possibly be, after you've had inpatient treatment. I mean, one thing I did want to mention about when I said about kind of patients who were on their second, third, fourth, I mean, I don't know whether this has changed, but there were like two pathways. So one was a crisis, which is, I think it was a predetermined 6 weeks. And then as full recovery, which was what I was on, because nobody told me about the kind of crisis admission, which I probably would have opted for had I had the choice, but not in retrospect, if you see what I mean. There's a kind of a really kind of pull there, isn't there? Because you opt to go in for a crisis admission, you know in advance when the 6 weeks is over and when your kind of get out of jail free card is up. So to me, it doesn't really, it saves somebody from serious illness, stroke, death sometimes, but it doesn't really incentivize you to kind of, you know, go for like full weight restoration, full recovery.
Yeah, and just to say, so we did some research on the two pathways. So the one pathway was for patients who did not want to recover and effectively came in to be medically stabilized. And so they typically would be partially weight restored for about 6 to 8 weeks and then discharged. But you know, the outcomes for those patients were very poor. And most of them, frankly, became, it's a horrible term, but revolving door patients. So partly weight restored, discharged back in 6 to 8 months, again and again and again. So although we initiated that pathway, you know, when we started the whole project, we, after 2 or 3 years, realized that, you know, the pathway has very poor success. And actually full weight restoration, and there are now, I think, at least 5 or 6 studies that have showed this, that full weight restoration is a key part of the recovery from an eating disorder. So it's very difficult to be malnourished and not think about food. And you know, so the eating disorder, being in a state of starvation, actually keeps the eating disorder going, because you're constantly thinking or about food. You can't live your life freely. But obviously weight restoration is just hard, you know, that's only a small part of it. So it's an essential part, but it's not, you know, you still need to do the psychological work around self-esteem, perfectionism, the traumas, body image, all the rules that you've had in the past, etc.
Yeah, and I feel like I think it's really important what you've highlighted there in terms of they're both equally important, and that in order to do that psychological work and to build a better foundation with self-esteem and things like that, ultimately you need to be in a nourished place. Because otherwise, you know, all you're thinking about is food and exercising and losing weight. And I'm not saying that once you get weight restored that those thoughts go away, but at least there's a little bit more to sort of work with there. So I guess just to finish us off, from all the kind of research that you did, what do you hope that will happen for ward rounds now? You know, is this something that's just happening in Oxford, or do you think, has this research kind of been distilled in other hospitals as well?
Yeah, so I presented it in one of the eating disorder conferences, and there were some other services who were interested in the study, which was great, because I think at the moment when I was doing the research, there was almost no research I could find that was specifically looking at ward rounds in eating disorder settings. And in general, I feel like when compared to outpatient and community treatments, inpatient research is very neglected, I would say, in comparison. So I think I would really hope that more research and services are pay attention to ward rounds and inpatient experience in general. So it's not just Oxford who was thinking about it. And I would also say, like what I said before, ward round is just one component, but the whole maybe issue lies in the whole like inpatient treatment in general. And so it really needs to be researched more, and people need to kind of pay attention to that a lot more, because there are lots of people who end up being in hospitals and not having very positive experience, but there are also people who have positive experience. So it's just kind of learning from people in general.
Gosh, this is, yeah, I would say, I mean, you know, one of the motivations was to kind of help a team who'd really helped me. So, and I would hope whatever work goes forward would help patients kind of find their reason to kind of get better, if you like, find their motivation. And part of what helps that is kind of seeing a process that works, trusting a process that works, and trusting the team that delivers it. And, you know, one of those things is the kind of ward round. So, yeah, that's probably what I'll say on that front.
I think I would say, I think you've both highlighted, you know, it's just one of the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. But we probably need to think and stop and think about the whole pathway, whether it's outpatients, community, how you go into the inpatient unit, what you receive on the inpatient unit, and then you know what happens after discharge and how we do handover. So there's something about thinking about the whole process and every step of the way that patients experience on the pathway, but then also about the content, you know. So it's also not just what you experience in terms of the process, but also what you actually receive. So our outcomes improved significantly when we started to offer, you know, a model that was evidence-based, so cognitive behavioral therapy, but as a whole team, rather than everybody doing their own preferred model. So I think that is important. I think it just highlights again how important service user and patient involvement is. You know, so it's absolutely crucial that we get feedback and that patients like Lynn are part of how we change our services, develop our services, and even the research. So. Yeah, so well done for Vanessa too, and for including Len in the whole process. And again, you know, it's so special to be publishing an article with an ex-patient. You know, I mean, what can be better in the world than to be co-publishers on an article that we've worked together on, after the person was in the service historically. So that is also very special. And then to do a podcast together. So how special is that?
Yeah, thank you to you, Lynn. But also, I would like to thank all the other patients who were involved as well. So when I first started this project, there was a patient eating disorder patients forum that I went to talk about my idea of the project and whether they felt that was a meaningful project to do. So I'm really grateful that they gave me some feedback and to kind of like some reassurance as well that it was relevant and it would be meaningful. And then I actually had another former patient who helped me in the beginning of the study before Lynn joined me in terms of like doing the data analysis together and then thinking about the service improvement strategy. So that was like, I've got a whole team of former patients helping me out in my doctorate. I'm really grateful to them.
No, it sounds fantastic. I think you've done really great work. And, you know, like you said, the importance of getting patients involved in that and understanding their perspective, I think is probably a massive element that's maybe been missed before, kind of just, you know, assuming that something's going to be right. But also, David, what you said about everybody being on the same page, I think that's what I was going to mention earlier, the importance of, you know, I can imagine if one person comes in with one type, you know, sometimes it's great to do lots of different types of therapies, depending on the presentation and stuff. But, you know, you really need that kind of basis of everybody kind of, you know, singing from the same hymn sheet and having the same goals for the patient. So, yeah, I think you've highlighted some really important things. So thank you all so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure. And like I said, it's so special to kind of get everyone's opinions rather than just one person who wrote the paper. So I hope you have enjoyed yourself as much as I have.
Thanks,
Hannah. Thank you. It was great. Thanks for having us.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.